Good afternoon. My name is Ten McDermott Rowe. The name of the show is In Context, PKN's live call-in political show. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hey, everybody.
And doing double duty behind the board is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be with you until 1 o'clock. Last week, we had a very interesting show with Congressman Ron Paul's national spokesman, Bruce Fein, and his interview is up on our website, incontextreport.com. That's incontextreport.com. That's our blog, and there's an archive of our shows. And I think, Gus, that show's also on YouTube now, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, we've had a lot of activity on that. And there's been a lot of activity in the news since we spoke to Bruce Fein. One of the subjects we talked about with him was the need to cut the federal deficit. And Congressman Ron Paul is the only candidate who's come out with a coherent plan to balance the budget in 4 years. And just today, it seems that the so-called super committee, a joint committee of Congress that's been tasked to set up tasked to come up with recommendations for $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years is now deadlocked. It looks like that's not going to happen. And let's put this in some perspective. The total budget's around $3 trillion, give or take a few hundred billion dollars.
And pocket change.
The pocket change. The deficit for the last year, fiscal year 2011, was around $1.5 trillion. Okay, so we're talking big sums of money. Now, the deficit so-called super committee, which can't seem to make any decisions, was talking about $1.2 trillion over 10 years. So a simple math can show you this is a drop in the bucket. This represents about – they're struggling over a 10% cut in our deficit. And the this really isn't that much money. And now what the sticking point is, even over this relatively small amount of deficit reduction, is the Democrats want tax increases, especially on higher income taxpayers. And the Republicans are opposed to that. They would like to, just to see cuts. Now, if they don't come to a resolution, and their deadline is this Wednesday at midnight, if they don't come to a resolution by then, supposedly in 2013, automatic cuts will go into effect.
2013, so it's not even next
year. Not even next year. You know, so I really don't think these cuts will ever happen. But supposedly in 2013, there's going to be equal cuts to reach this $1.2 trillion over 10 years domestic spending, so-called discretionary domestic spending, which that excludes Social Security. So if they fail, Social Security will not be cut. And the other half of it's supposed to be in the military budget, which, as we were discussing earlier, Gus, it really isn't cuts in spending. Even these cuts that they're struggling with aren't really cuts, are they?
No. Well, Senator John Kyle, who is a Republican on the supposed super committee, you know, not that they're has ever been a super committee before. It's just some kind of fake creation that they just came up with to try to, you know, usurp our equal representation. So I'm completely against this whole super committee thing. And anybody could have told you that this would have ended in deadlock, right?
Yeah. Well, isn't Congress's job to pass appropriations
bills and to
make
represent
decisions
us
like this? Yeah.
But anyway, Senator John Kyle said that the proposed cuts, or rather the automatic cuts that would go into effect on the defense budget, are draconian. Now, this is probably the most inappropriate usage of the word draconian I've ever heard. Usually when you're referring to cost cuts in social network spending or infrastructure, that's draconian because people could die. But, well, I guess by inference, people could die from the lack of defense, except that Senator Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, came out and said that, no, it's not actually a cut in defense. It's a cut in the regularly scheduled increase of expenditures for defense.
That's Washington speak. If you just joined us, the name of the show is In Context, WPKN's live call-in show, political call-in show, and you can reach us at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or if you prefer, you can email us a question or comment to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. Yeah, imagine if you ran your own domestic economy in this fashion. You earned $50,000 a year and you spent $100,000 a year, and then you told your creditors, well, you know, next year I'll cut my spending to $95,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's analogous to that situation. You have absolutely no credibility.
Right. No, it's just window dressing. But even still, I mean, the defense budget is still going to increase by 16%. So how can we even have this conversation? In the Bloomberg article I was reading this morning about these automatic cuts. Sounds okay to me. All the people interviewed, you know, Patty Murray and all these different people on the super committee, they still said that the defense thing is supposedly untouchable. They all, even the Republicans and the Democrats, all of them agree we shouldn't cut defense. But I mean, that's our biggest consumption of our money. That's just wasteful.
That's almost one.
It produces
almost $1 trillion.
At least with the social stuff like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. I know those are big drags and welfare and all that sort of stuff. But at least somebody gets some benefit from
exactly.
It.
Exactly. It's staying here, and we're not building bridges in Afghanistan
and then blowing them up.
Listeners, what do you think? If you're, let's say you're in the Congress, what would you cut if you got a $3 trillion in spending and $1.5 trillion in revenue? What would you cut? Would you increase taxes? Should we increase taxes on middle class Americans? Should we increase taxes only on the very wealthy? Should we just not increase taxes at all and focus on cutting this $3 trillion in spending?
And remember, you know, we were talking the other day about who considers themselves middle class. You know, I just can't resist. You just mentioned that phrase, and you know. Almost everyone in the country considers themselves middle class. Very few people consider themselves low class or I guess upper class or whatever. But when you really look at what defines middle class, what, like 70% of people are in low class? So it's like 66%, something like that, are actually in the lower class. If you are talking about what it costs to live in your area, you know, cost of living and so forth. You know, just because you think that you have the mindset of being middle class, or maybe you have middle class education.
It's a social phenomenon. Well, look at a lot of these young people out there in Occupy Wall Street who are very well educated, and they're unemployed or underemployed, and they're carrying enormous debt from the unconscionable tuitions. And we've done a show on this, the tuition that colleges are charging people
completely out of proportion, and for especially the jobs.
Yes, and of course they're middle class, but the big story of the last generation is a downward.
Wait, you think they are middle class?
I think that their perception is they're middle class.
You know, you think their perception is.
You know, economically
speaking.
Economically, they're poor, and that's the big story, I think, of the last generation.
I think, though, what's interesting is that's the most dangerous, though, group is the people who were the middle class, those who are educated, who now don't have anything or have less than they did before. Because Trotsky famously once said that revolution does not come from the peasantry, like Marx originally stipulated, because the peasantry don't have they have nothing to lose, but they're afraid of losing the little that they have. The bourgeoisie are afraid of losing what they have because they have so much. But it's the educated, disenfranchised middle class have just enough to gain.
That's a good observation, Marshall.
Would the difference be, you know, of course you're right, but now the modern comparison, though, is the problem that the result of the education is a completely depleted public education system that doesn't teach anyone any kind of context or critical thinking. So you end up with these pseudo-intellectuals who are protesting, who want their education paid for free by who they perceive to be rich, but they're really just lower middle class people with a mortgage. And they're actually more in debt than anyone else could possibly perceive.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at people who have bought their house, say, in 2005, maybe they make $250,000, $300,000 a year, but they still have 20 years to go on their mortgage.
Yeah.
And they have supposedly to pay anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000 a year for their two or three kids to go to college. You know, are those people really wealthy? But compared to the person who doesn't have
really,
a job,
there isn't enough
$150,000 in
debt.
When
you're looking at $60,000 a year for college, nobody has enough money.
No one's got enough money.
You know, when they talk in these protests about the 1%, I think it is a pretty good description of what's happened in America over the last generation. Is the middle class has really gotten gutted. And Elizabeth Warren is running for the Senate in Massachusetts. Has an excellent piece you can see on YouTube where she describes quantitatively the decline of the middle class. Oh, she goes back to around 1970, and the earning potential has just gone down the toilet, and people have no savings anymore. And so they've only been living, she said, only survive as middle class by doing two things. Mom is in the workforce, the children are in daycare, and they borrow money they borrow money and they borrow and they borrow money on credit cards and this and that.
With the
and
hope that they're going to make money to pay it back. But that never happens.
And it's not happening.
Isn't that kind of like gambling? You know, you throw all your money down in the house.
But you can't say they're foolish. What choice do they have? They're dealing with the world the way it is. You want to send your child to college? Well, it's X dollars, like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, talk about gambling. You know, the Dow today is down 250 points right now, I think. And, you know, the market, that's a casino.
It is
you know, it's a completely rigged casino run by the investment banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Citibank, and they are constantly running this scam to try to get the middle class to put their savings into the market so that they can just repeatedly steal it over and over and over again. You know, last week we were talking to Bruce Fein, spokesman for Ron Paul's presidential campaign, and we had a call that asked about the bailouts and the banks, how they were able to actually pay back the money that they were loaned. And the thought occurred to me, but we were moving so fast, I wasn't able to get it out. But the banks engage in fractional reserve banking. So they're loaned money from the Fed. They then turn around, multiply that by six, and then they were able to easily pay back the money that they were loaned and give themselves huge bonuses and increase their purchasing power in the market. And then they end up hoarding all the money and not loaning it out. So people wonder, how are they able to pay back the loans? It's because they fractionally reserve the money they were borrowed.
Let's run that over again. This depression, and I think that's what it is, really been caused by financial manipulation. Overexpansion of the money supply by the Federal Reserve led to this huge housing bubble. And so the poor middle-class family's got to go out and buy a house in an inflated market. He has no choice, okay? So then they made it much worse because they created all these phony instruments, these derivative instruments. They did it because Congress failed to regulate it because of the bank's influence. And so this exponentially increased the severity of this housing bubble. They say the notional value of what they call the derivative market is something like 20 times the world's GDP. I mean, it's just enormous.
Yeah, it's like $1.5 quadrillion.
It's too many zeros to even count. And so that's what's dragging this country down. So it's a financially driven depression. And the rest of us are left holding the bag.
And the derivatives are so shady because they are a bet on a bet on a bet. So you can make a bet on the same and cover your bet with another bet. You know, so it's multiplying the amount of hypothetical money in existence.
That's right.
Every time you make one of these
bets,
because
there's no underlying value to it. It's just a bet.
Yeah, exactly. It's there's nothing bet. Backing
and
it
so
up.
What
there's
happened,
no collateral.
And when the party ended, who had to pay for it? The trillions of dollars that was used to – the taxpayer money is used to bail out
the
guys who had the party.
And that's why Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, these countries, the pigs countries and others who are supposedly in all this debt, they're not in any of this actual debt. It's not for anything they received. It's not like they all – everyone in Greece ordered luxurious jewelry and Lexus for everyone in the country and went on vacation permanently.
Yeah.
They didn't get anything for the money. All they did was just spend all of their trust funds and retirement savings accounts on derivatives and other financial instruments, and all that money just vaporized into the market. And now all of a sudden they owe it to somebody. But don't owe it to anybody. It's just a bank that demands that they get repaid.
And
they're going to take their private islands and so forth. And I think Max Kaiser told a story. He was in Greece reporting on the riots last summer, and he saw Steve Forbes there, the famous businessman. And he bumped into him in the lobby, and they knew each other back from when Max Kaiser was a stock trader in New York City. And Forbes said, Max, can you believe it? We're making out like bandits here. This is great. I just bought an island for pennies.
That's right. That's the beauty of it, because if you're liquid, and if you'd like to join our conversation, we started off talking about the super committee's failure to deal with this crushing debt that the United States has. If you'd like to join our conversation at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. You can speak to Gus or to me. My name's Ken McDermott Rowe or Marchand. Or you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. You know, the markets are really important. Gus was just mentioning the stock market's down 250 points. We also have a market for our debt, which is now, get this, folks, we have $15 trillion in our national debt. It's approximately equal to our entire GDP. And when you cross that line, mm-hmm. where you're getting over 100% of your yep. debt is over 100% of your GDP, you're really moving into banana republic.
And it's supposed to – the sustainable level is something like, what, 40% or something like that?
Something like that. Over 100%. You're really hurting.
You're really asking for trouble.
Now, the Chinese have said that they are considering a third downgrade of our debt mm-hmm. as a result of these huge deficits. They downgraded us 12 months ago from AA to A+, and then again in August from down to single A. So this is really, this is a pretty sorry commentary. Do we have a phone call, Marshawn?
We have a caller on the air, Brendan calling from the highway.
Hi, Brendan.
Well,
what's on your mind?
I wanted to talk to you guys about kind of the way that you were speaking about the education system before, and I have a little bit of a comparison to the prison industry.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, these days, we have a lot of kids that are going out there, and ever since we were little, we were told to follow our dreams, and, our dreams would come true if you worked hard and did this and did that. But if you notice... If you compare the amount of hours that a kid in the engineering program studies versus a kid in the communications program, how can you justify, when the engineering kid gets out of school and gets $80,000 to $100,000 a year right out of school versus the communications kid that might not get a job out of school, how can they pay the same amount of money? It's almost ridiculous.
Brendan, do you think that's a very good point?
Yeah, very good. Very
do you
good
think,
point.
Brendan, that they're going to banks or the government, which guarantees loans, is going to start to be selective and say, "We'll loan you money for engineering, but we won't loan you money to go to school to study communications"?
I don't even think it's like that. I think it needs to be a totally institutional realignment where if you want to study something where you're not going to get a good job out of school, you should do that at community college and give the community colleges the resources to teach those things.
Yes.
But if you want to go and pay the big money for the big school, you should be getting an education that you can actually use.
I agree with you completely. Yes. We've talked about this before, how I made the comparison of someone going to Duke for an undergrad and then going on to teaching. You're capped at how much you can earn as a teacher. So you're actually going to go and pay your entire yearly salary of your work just for that undergrad degree, just so you can compete for the job you probably won't even get. So you're going to pay $46,000 a year.
And the amount of loans that you stack up versus, a kid that might have gone to state and can get the same job as you because they have connections.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of a crazy system. And the reason I like to compare it to the prison system.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is because, when you're a good kid after high school, you're expected to go to college. When you're a bad kid and you get in trouble, you get sent to prison.
Uh-huh.
And either way, there is big money in both of these industries. And when we took the manufacturing jobs out of this country, someplace, we needed to put all of these people. And it was either going to be in college or it was going to be in prison.
What a terrific analogy.
What else are we going to do? It's big money.
Or the Army.
Yeah, or the Army. I mean, there's a lot of things, but when we don't have jobs for these folks, we've got to continue to find ways to do these things. And actually, when we created the prison industry instead of the correctional system, we're creating jobs and incarcerating people.
And you're exactly right. We're
doing the same thing by creating phony baloney majors in college that kids are paying out the nose for their entire lives.
Yeah, like sports management.
Yeah, seriously.
Right.
I mean, you think about how many kids that are going out there to learn to become museum curators and how many museums there are out there and how many people already have those jobs.
Exactly.
Unless we're going to be building more museums or we're going to be killing off museum curators, you're not
going to have those jobs. Got to create a shortage of curators.
What was that, Ernie Kovacs?
Wow. Thank you so much for the call.
Thanks very much, Brendan.
Terrific.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
You too.
He makes a lot of really good points. And you know what? To back up the prison industry, which is private in most cases, we have to have laws that are created to put people in jail. Because if things aren't illegal, then obviously you have no prison population. You have no jobs for these prison guards. You're not paying the private contractors to wash the uniforms and feed the guys. It's a business, just like anything else. And the public police law enforcement officials, not public servants anymore, they're officials, they run around and they just create customers. And if there aren't any in an area, then they just become the drug dealers, and then they bust the people who buy it.
I think part of the problem is a political dynamic is that the prison complex, the education complex, they've all become part of what President Eisenhower warned about when he talked about the military-industrial complex controlling our government. It seems like one industry, pharmaceuticals, prisons, universities, they all joined this complex, and they're running public policy for their own benefit. I mean, how can it possibly be in the national interest to have a private college is charging $57,000, $58,000 a year? How did they get away with it?
Totally unsustainable.
Why were they allowed to do it? If the minimum wage had been indexed to college over the last generation, instead of being about $7 an hour, it'd be like $22 an hour.
Yeah.
Why did they get away with it? I think the government should step in. This is the view I've expressed in our show on tuition. Is they should be told to roll back their tuition to keep – bring it in line with wages or not get any kind of government support. Because why should we subsidize this?
Well, just like, you know what, and I can tell you what the argument against that is going to be, not that I agree with it, but just like when you have government that's become too big, then you say, well, now we have all these people employed. What are we going to do, lay them all off? And if you lower tuition at colleges, then you're going to have to start laying off support staff who don't do anything at the college
education. There's going to be a difficult readjustment, but we have to, I think, make up for that by, I would say, a massive program of infrastructure improvement in this country to create high-paying jobs and to increase our national competitiveness. Yeah. And that's what built this country. People, the Republicans say, oh, government's bad, you know, oh, we got the private sector's always the answer. But that's not how this country is built. If you look at the 19th century growth in the American economy, it was built on government-led projects, sometimes privately and publicly funded, sometimes just publicly funded, from the Erie Canal to the National Road to the Transcontinental Railroad, right up to President Eisenhower's interstate highway system.
Yeah, I know. You know what's ironic about that, though? The government always finds a way to take a noble project and then turn it into a burden. You know, so for instance, we may say, okay, we need an overhaul of our transportation system because it's completely outdated.
Right.
It's a complete wreck. And no one will argue with that.
Yeah.
Anyone who has a car or ever driven an overhaul will understand that. What they'll do is they'll raise the tax to say, to pay for this, we have to raise the tax. And then they'll just keep that tax there forever, like a toll plaza. You know,
right,
they say
right.
We're going to put the toll plaza here until the road's paid for, but then it never goes away.
Well, these projects have to be there are going to be mistakes, but the projects have to be done based upon what we think is important and not based upon what some industry would.
It would have to be a direct democracy type of situation where people get to vote online. You know, people like Gerald Celente advocate direct democracy. Where, you know, we basically bypass our elected representatives because they're totally corrupt.
That's a good idea. I mean, we need more democracy in this country, not less.
I know. Obviously, the problem there is that you are going to be completely the special interest groups would even further saturate the market with propaganda, advertising.
So then you get back to this is a theme of our program, In Context, and you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, streaming at WPKN.org, is the Federal Reserve and how that anchors this corporate-dominated government.
Exactly. We could solve the problem.
Oh, excuse me. I think we have a phone.
Hold on. Let me just finish my thought. We could solve the problem not necessarily by raising taxes or by even changing our elected representative democracy. We could solve the whole problem by just getting rid of or nationalizing the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
That would solve a lot of problems.
Money's key. And we have a caller?
We have a caller, Kathy from Setauket, Long Island.
Hi, okay. Kathy. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm interested in the changes that you're talking about making, but how would you do that to get all the people to agree on these changes? Aren't we all fractured and in different groups? You sound like we need a revolution.
I think what, Kathy, that's a really good question. I think how democracy is supposed to work is that we have a conversation, Gus and Marshawn and myself and Kathy, and we get educated and we decide what the priorities are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And then we communicate our priorities to Jim Hines and these other people that are in office, and they're supposed to carry it out.
Hopefully someone other than Jim Hines.
And that's the way it's supposed to happen, and that's why we do the show we do and why we're so glad that people like you, Kathy, participate in the show, because this conversation is the basis of democracy. But unfortunately, what we have now is a one-way conversation, and it comes from the corporate government dominated down to us. And we don't have any way of getting back to it. So I think part of the answer has to be with our at the grassroots community organizing, community-based media like WPKN, stimulating discussion and developing consensus. I mean, should we have a high-speed rail? Should we have a decentralized energy system? Should we put hundreds of millions of dollars into a smart energy grid instead? Should we have renewables? Should we do natural gas? These are the conversations that we should be having, and then informing people like Jim Himes.
I like what you're saying. I hope we get these changes. I love what you're talking about. You know, I just hope that I can get the people to vote. I find that most people are very scared to make a change. They kind of more comfortable with the status quo. They don't feel they have the power, maybe. I'm talking about just common people that I just happen to meet. I don't know how educated or uneducated they are, but they often seem to think, gee, I can't do anything about this. I don't know. You know, that's really kind of the response to everything. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it is our responsibility to be informed. Without education and without an informed populace, the Republic can't stand. It's impossible for our way of life to perpetuate itself without education and without determination. And people, I think the whole point of this central government that's distant, far away, centralized in Washington, D.C., is it makes us all feel small. It makes us feel like we can't affect any change. And that's why the biggest thing that we have to do is bring the control back to the states. And that's exactly why the Southern Poverty Law Center goes around and says that people who are 10th Amendment advocates are racist because, you know, they're terrorists or they're weirdos or whatever. They're extremists. Because that is the biggest way that we can actually affect change is at our local government and state level. And that's the biggest enemy of the federal government and any of these major corporations who run our government. They don't want state controls. Because then you can have people in each region deciding what's good for their banking regulations, what's good for their transportation, what's good for their environment, what's good for their education. Not, the biggest states and the biggest corporations lobbying to affect change in Vermont and New Hampshire. Like, what do they care what happens in California? It's a completely different environment.
What's the biggest issue to you, Kathy, as we're approaching this presidential race? What should the candidates be talking to you about?
Well, I have two children who aren't in college yet, but I worry about being able to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
I remember going to college myself, and I went to City University of New York. It was free till about 1976, I believe. I think there was a minimum. It was open enrollment. Basically, anybody could go to college and maybe try their hand at museum curating or something like
right.
that, but it didn't cost you a big arm and a leg. I studied what I liked. I didn't study something that was going to get me a job. I studied Latin and Greek, and I wasn't going to get a job being a Latin. I didn't think I would possibly get a job, being a Latin or Greek teacher. Those are really hard jobs to find, but
uh-huh.
when I used to go on job interviews, they would say to me, but I see that you studied and you have this kind of study ethic and we're interested in you
yeah.
because you studied, and that's why I went to college. Now, I wonder about my daughters. Are they going to be able to choose what they want to study? Or are they going to have to, like, scratch their head and say, well, gee, I need a job.
What a great,
study that.
great comment, because that and actually dovetails with our last caller who was talking about the cost of education being disproportionate to the type of job you're going to get and what it pays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you had the luxury of choosing something you liked to study
yes.
instead of being forced into studying something that you thought would pay off.
Yeah.
Because now this has become a race for resource and people have to be watching the job market to see what's a growth economy,
mm-hmm.
As if we're from a third world nation
yes.
and saying, well, this crop is going to be good. So I'm going to transfer my
yes.
crops from corn
yeah.
to grow something else, Why should we have
really
to look at it that way?
I feel sorry for kids now because then they can't dabble in things like philosophy or whatever.
Which enriches society.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just makes us a better group of people if we think outside the box.
Uh-huh.
But if you have to pay the bills, it's really hard to think outside the box. There's really no time. And I want to hear more conversations like yours, but I fear that the young people don't have time to think about
yeah.
this.
It does take free time, and if we're just worker bees all the time, maybe that suits the interest of the corporations that run the government.
That is the whole point. Bogging us down with red tape and taxes and so that we constantly have to be working two jobs that we can't afford, we don't earn a living wage.
Right.
Both parents are in the workplace.
Right.
Nobody's raising the children.
Right.
That's the whole point.
But there's more to life.
There's much more to life than that, yeah.
Absolutely, and that's what I hope for my daughters, that they'll be able to choose – what they want to study at not exorbitant costs. Mm-hmm. That's my biggest concern right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I would also think, as far as the growth of our economy goes and our next generation, I would like people to be fearless about being entrepreneurs. You know, I myself am a small business person, and I'm like scared to death that I'm going to actually grow, because then now all of a sudden I have to be worried about getting audited and all these new taxes and regulations that I'm unaware of. Now all of a sudden I have to spend a quarter of my day reading and researching laws to try to figure out whether I'm going to get sued or go to jail because the IRS is on my butt.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So those are my concerns. I really enjoy your show, and I always feel that I get a lot out of it by listening to you. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Kathy.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, a lot of good points there. And, you know, we do need to fear for the next generations. You know, there's an education vacuum. There's an awareness vacuum. Most people don't feel empowered. They don't feel like they can make a difference. They feel like their voices don't count. They feel, you know, you get what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
no.
Yeah, we feel like our hearts have hit the floor all of a sudden. Everybody invested emotionally in Obama in the last election, and now all of a sudden, you know, what's he even talking about as far as his reelection campaign? What's he talking about? Like,
it's the same,
what does he offer?
It's the same thing every 4 years. They give us the illusion of a choice, and Obama was probably the best example of that. Because people thought they were going to get a change. And what did he do? He implied he would end the war. I think people thought they were voting for an end of the war.
You know,
and the war's been greatly expanded.
He stabbed everyone in the back. He's not done anything to actually help empower the people. You know, his slogan, "Yes, We Can," is a study in propaganda, because it implies that whatever's important to you makes you feel like you can get it accomplished, but he has not actually endorsed what you said.
He's
very slick.
Good. He's very good at what he does. Do we have another phone call, Marchand?
We do have another caller. This is WPKN's own Johnny B. Good.
Hi, John. How are you?
Yes. I can't help but I'm here, and I hear your conversations going on, and it's also interesting. On the states' rights thing, though, I don't know about that. I'm sure if the states' rights were in Florida at the time of the last of two elections ago, we probably would have had a different world as we know it from the Supreme Court overturning the state and electing George Bush as president. That was quite an effect of states' rights. And then that's the, to me, that's the if the states had rights, that would have been a positive thing. But then back in the 60s, if the states had the ultimate say over their own schools and such, where would the civil rights have been today? What would have happened to segregation down there?
Well, states' rights doesn't override the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or anything like that. So when you are talking about what defines a human being and whether everyone has equal protection, that overrides states' rights. I mean, one amendment doesn't allow a state to violate another amendment. You know what I'm saying?
I think that's a good point, John Smith.
He makes a good point.
Because the civil rights movement came from the federal government, and it was a very important initiative. And a lot of the infrastructure things that we were talking about before, the state college system was a federal innovation. Mm-hmm. Our public state university system came about because of Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
Well, how do you divide it? What are your numbers? How do you make it possible to divide one from the other when you're talking about states' rights?
You mean how do you divide?
Well, no, because the states agree to the Bill of Rights. They ratify the amendments. So you can't say – so you actually can enforce the Bill of Rights or amendment on the state, or you force them to secede. That's what it's originally designed to do. If you don't want to abide by these laws, then you have to secede from the union. That's what it's designed to do. And if that state secedes, obviously the people who don't agree with the way that new nation is going will just leave the country.
I think there's a broad consensus, John, that this federal government should be strong in protecting people's rights. But on the other hand, do we need a federal Department of Education?
No, the federal Department of Education
doesn't.
Well,
that's what involved the civil rights movement down there.
But that was created under Carter. And
yeah, that's a different issue.
You know, I mean, is education, are we any better off because there's a huge federal bureaucracy in an industry that was once public, local public schools? You know, if we eliminated it tomorrow, would it make any difference to education in America?
No.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect.
No, because, I mean, for instance, my son is now studying for the CAP test. What's the CAP test? It's just a way for them to analyze the performance of the public school. And the teachers, all they do is spend all their time prepping the students to study for the CAP test.
So you could argue that it's actually disruptive.
It's a completely disruptive method to the classroom. And if you have classrooms in New York City and all these inner cities where the teachers are actually altering the answers on the tests in order to keep themselves from getting fired. So they just give the kids the answers to the test.
But this is the kind of discussion we should have, John, is what is the federal government do best, and where is it doing stuff that's really
right.
counterproductive or you know, wasteful?
What the federal government does well is national defense and interstate regulation of commerce. That's what it's for.
And I would say protecting people's rights, too. I think it's in states where, for example, in the South.
Well, how do you
where
feel
was,
about
you
know, how it stepped in on the present issue with the Supreme Court?
What issue?
For what, the health care bill?
In Florida, when they decided they overruled the state's decision to recount the ballots. How did you feel about that?
Well, I mean, you know what? Does any of that really matter? I mean, because, for example...
Of course it matters. It changed the history of the world, for crying out loud.
No, what I mean is that it wasn't really the state that had anything to do with it. George Bush put his lackeys in the government. I mean, you know, they were people who were actually apologizing for him and enforcing things. What was that woman's? Catherine, what's her name, in Florida?
Yes.
You know, his brother was the governor. Catherine
Harris.
And his brother was the governor of the state, and Karl Rove had his operatives all over the country.
Yeah, that was a pretty crooked deal.
In Ohio, for example.
Well, I know
they had,
it was.
In Ohio, they had...
Crooked. Why did it become crooked?
In Ohio, they had automated voting machines.
Well, remember when...
They had automated voting machines, and they were rigged, and the guy who was in charge of rigging them...
I don't want to take up your whole show here.
...died in a plane crash. The guy who rigged the machines died in a plane crash. That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't matter. We have to keep the states independent, because everything can be rigged, and we can't allow this stuff to affect our national outcome.
You've raised some really interesting issues, and thanks for calling, John.
Okay, I'm back. I'll talk to you guys later.
Great.
It up.
All right, thank
thanks,
you.
Johnny.
Thank you, John.
This does raise, though, an interesting question. I mean, if the ballots could have been rigged before, well, what gives people confidence that we still are going to have a free election, that we are not turning into a banana republic?
I know, and that's the thing. Anywhere you see automatic electronic voting machines going in, get out there and protest them, because they can be rigged, they can be affected, and that's how Chicago alters their votes, and that's how New York City alters their election outcomes. It's hard to rig an election on a grand scale. So if you have elections going on statewide, going for one candidate in multiple places, then that is going to raise a lot of red flags. That's going to be discovered. But if it's one county here and one county there, like Ohio was, they had two or three key counties that went in the wrong direction, and they went complete opposite of the exit polls. Then that's you know, a lot easier to cover up. And the guy who was the IT specialist who designed those systems and put the back doors in so that they could alter the vote counts, he died in the plane crash on his way to go give a deposition.
But that happens all the time. Surely don't people die in plane crashes on a regular basis, particularly if they're important? I mean, it seems like a health risk to be important, you know?
I know.
You don't want to take an unpopular position and take a plane. Like, if you're really important.
Especially your own plane.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This is In Context, is our weekly political call-in show on Mondays from noon to 1 p.m. And our website is it's incontextreport.com, incontextreport.com. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero and our board operator and military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. And we've been talking about this horrible deficit, kind of as and the failure of the supercommittee. There was a follow on to our conversation last week with Congressman Ron Paul's national spokesman, Bruce Fine, because the congressman has the first and only candidate, I think, who's put out a balanced budget proposal. And we've been moving along to talk about the failure of our government to respond really to the citizens' wishes and how the middle class is taking a drubbing. And I noticed, Gus, that one of the ways people seem to be pushing back, and I don't know how effective it's going to be, is this, as the Christmas shopping holiday approaches, that there's now one of the employees at Target is circulating a petition to prevent the store. It says, push back the opening of the retail stores at Target on Black Friday to 5 a.m. Apparently, they're going to open at midnight. And this man's name is Anthony Hardwick. He was a parking attendant for 3 years at Target's in Omaha, Nebraska. And his feeling was it's just not fair to the workers at Target. They should have the chance to be with their families on Thanksgiving. And I think it goes to the question that in contemporary society, the average person has so little power. But one of the ways maybe he can push back, and this addresses Kathy's concern with their friends that they have no power, there's nothing they can do. Here's a man, this Anthony Hardwick, is trying to do something. And he has, last I checked, over about 200,000 signatures on the petition. So is this a practical way for people to push back? And what does it say more in the broad sense about our attitude towards business and commercialism?
Yeah, it exposes the corruption and the greed, but it's promptly ignored. I mean, they're advertising on TV that they're going to be open at midnight, and they will.
Yeah.
And the guy even said, you know, if the store ignores your petition and they open anyway, are you going to work? He said, yeah, of course I'll be there.
I guess, yeah,
so what they need is a mass protest of the employees. They have to say, we're not going to be here.
Well, and I remember working in Toledo, where especially in a bad economy, you see this. I was called into work on my one day off. I worked 70 hours a week and I managed to get one day off. And I was called in and told to come into work. And I said, you know, look, boss, I got a wife at home and stuff. I said, you know, I haven't seen her all week. Can I at least have today off? And he says, you have today off. Don't bother coming in tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It was that simple. And so I didn't like the way I was being treated. Neither did any of the employees. And I talked to the other employees about organizing some sort of either union or boycott, or saying, you know, we could, because it's a restaurant, for goodness sakes, you know, you pick at that. I mean, customers will whittle away. None of them wanted to risk losing their jobs. It was that nobody was willing to make a stand because of that.
Yeah. And you know, here we have an email from Bonnie in Greenwich, and she says, when it comes to corporate greed and control, it has been said that opening stores at midnight at Thanksgiving is a symbol of corporate serfdom combined with toxic consumerism. What do you think of that, and what can be done? And, you know, it completely relates to what we're talking about here, because you've got people who are addicted to $8 an hour wages, or in some cases less, and they can't even afford to not earn that much. And that's so little that you can't even pay for your transportation and three meals in a day after your taxes. And have
it's not
anything
that,
to show.
It is absolutely,
at the end of the week, you've earned $250.
We were talking about college tuition. Compare $8 an hour a job to what it costs to go to a college. Even a state university now is $40,000 to $45,000 out of state, because you probably can't get in state anymore because it's, you know, there's so much competition. Mm-hmm. And what do you make? $8, I'm doing it quickly in my head. It's what, $15,000 a year? Mm-hmm. That's it?
That's like, my rent.
That's nothing.
That's less than
it's
my
nothing.
Rent.
If people work full time for that, we're at, you can reach us at 203-336-9756 to join our conversation. That's 203-336-9756. My name's Ken. I'm here with Gus and Marchand.
So then what's the answer? Is it it's not that we have to mandate the increase of wages, because that's going to increase the prices that we pay. So what's, you know, what do we do there?
It seems to me
rent control.
My sense is that we're in a deflationary cycle, and we are not going to, you're not going to see wage increases. That's you, if you look at the 10-year bonds are now under 2%. People are not, the people with the big money are not expecting inflation.
Well, we are seeing wage inflation in some regions, because Nancy Pelosi said that her wealth has increased 60% since 2008, and
that's
from insider trading, basically.
Yeah.
She knows which way the regulations and the laws are going to go and which ones are going to be passed, and she adjusts her investments accordingly.
So why isn't she in trouble?
60%.
Why isn't she in trouble like Martha Stewart? She took a tip from a friend.
Because it's legal.
Slammer, yeah.
Well, it's 60 Minutes. They did a piece, and they
yes.
called it soft corruption.
Yeah.
And they said it's legal insider trading.
But because congressmen know in advance, obviously, what legislation is likely to pass and how this will affect the market.
And that's why it costs so much to become a senator. That's why it costs so much to be a representative. It costs more than the job pays by a factor of like 50 to 1.
Off the charts.
Or more.
Well, they're almost like brokers. You know, sometimes we joke that maybe we should just get rid of the Congress and just have the government run directly by the corporations, and they can come in and they say, okay.
Cut out the middleman.
Cut out the middleman. government. Halliburton, you know, here's $10 billion for you.
The congressman from Halliburton votes yay.
Well, it was like Robin Williams famously said. He said, you know, that we should have them like NASCAR racers, you know, with the names of the people who sponsor them on their jackets. Then you might have some idea why the heck they voted that way.
Yeah, really, really.
Well, we read off the list of contributors to the congressional candidates at the last congressional election. And it was one for both the incumbent and the challenger. It was one bank after another bank. And you got to believe that these guys pay attention when the phone rings from somebody who sent you substantial contributions.
Oh, they have a red line. They have the bat phone.
Right.
You know, it's a direct line right to them. You know, they don't call up and get the idiot assistant in the front who doesn't even, you know what to do.
Right, right.
You know, yes, I'd like to register a complaint against, you know, SB 607. Which one is that?
That's right. Okay. I'll make a note.
Okay,
the congressman.
What's your name? I'll be sure to tell the congressman.
Well, I think we have another caller.
Yes, this is
Jim from
Hello.
Fairfield.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. Hi. You're on the air.
Thanks a lot. I just happened to stumble across your show this afternoon, and we talk about fair elections and what we can do to make change, and I've been paying attention to the last year or so about how the voting districts are always realigned to line up with political parties, and we always want fair elections, but in our current system, we'll never have what you consider a balanced playing field if the districts are always aligned based on political parties, meaning like if the Republicans are in control of the state, they're always going to realign the districts to favor their party, and it goes with the Democrats as well. I'd like to see a more balanced approach to redistricting, not based on party affiliations. If you ever look at a district map, it's absolutely weird in shape.
They call it gerrymandering.
Right, gerrymandering. Right. And that's, I guess it's been going on for as long as we've had voting, but it just seems that we're always going to have safe districts, and they're always going to be safe, and then you can never have a alternative candidate in those safe districts.
Mm-hmm. That's an important point. More importantly than keeping the Republicans or Democrats in control, it's to keep the third party out, to make sure that they can't get a seat anywhere.
That's right. And so when we always say, well, we need a third party, it's impossible to run a third party in any district practically. You get 1% of the vote if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's millions of dollars to run a congressional campaign even. And if you're a third party, you're never going to get any noticed.
Oh, yeah, and that's why, you know, Ron Paul's been asked, will he run as an independent? He's not going to play that card yet. He wants to make sure he can use the machinery of the Republican Party to back him, that infinite pool of wealth, to be able to pay for that presidential campaign. If you run as an independent, you have to raise all that money.
So, caller, Jim, do you think that it would help if we somehow could break this duopoly, the Republican-Democrat monopoly of our system?
I think it would help. I think it would create more compromise if there was a third party that had a significant presence in any of the legislatures, whether it's Congress or at the state houses. I think that right now we play ping pong with our bills, that they go either one way or the other, and there's never the third way. Because right in the middle, there's that core middle of the constituency that can go either way, but neither side matches their needs.
It's, you know, it's fun. You mentioned the third way is actually the title of a book by Adrian Kuzminski, who we've had on the show, and he talks about how the failure of the Democratic and Republican parties to represent the people. He says essentially they only represent the corporate interests, so that you're not getting a choice. And what he proposes is a third way, which would be a populist type of political system based upon Jeffersonian democracy.
Well, there's certainly enough third parties out there, whether it's the Green Party, the Working Family Party, the Libertarian,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure there's something we all can find that we like, but none of them will gather enough money or attention to be credible, and it also has to do with the media as well. The media does not want to pay attention to third-party candidates.
That's
no,
so
they have
true.
A cozy relationship,
it's
but
so
they don't want to get it messed up.
Well, that's why, you know, we keep plugging away here at WBCAN with our community-based programming, because this is the only way, I think, that people can have a voice which is independent from the corporate-controlled media. So I would thank you, Jim, for participating in the show.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, you know, anyway, we were talking about the commercialization of holidays, and, you know, it's good to note that I started seeing Christmas decorations going up in Bed Bath & Beyond on October 13th.
October 13th. I see. Either they're very religious or they're very commercial. I don't, you can take your guess.
Yeah, well, I didn't see any religious symbols there, so I don't think that it was too much about the celebration of the holiday. Clearly, this is just a way to make money, and you cut out an ad that from Kenneth Cole, and the tagline on it, it's two really lovely-looking people dressed rather luxuriously, and the tagline is, it's not, emphasis added on the not, it's not the thought that counts. And then Kenneth Cole has his scribble signature underneath
it.
He's
very proud to
say that. He's proud to be associated with that. You know, and I went online and looked up to see what the other taglines are. And, you know, like on the backside, it says, it's not the thought that counts, it's the warm embrace of our fur collar coat.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, what are the holidays about again? It's
exactly.
Not the thought that counts. So it's about just possessions?
It's about buying stuff. And you know, we're better than
this. That's disgusting.
We're better than this. I mean, whether you're a Christian and you observe Christmas as the birth of Jesus or not, we're all better than this. That's not what we're about as Americans, as human beings.
If you watch old movies that take place around Christmas or something like that, a common theme you'll see is the family goes out on Christmas Eve to the main street in the small town that they live in, and they'll just walk from the different general stores and buy little trinkets for each other, spending no more than just a few dollars. And in some cases, kids make gifts for each other for their parents, or you know, the gifts that they would give were about spending time with each other or something that was really thoughtful. Obviously, they thought about it a lot. And now it's just about buying its possessions. It's about consumption. And most of the time, I stopped buying cheap gifts years ago when I bought something at Toys R Us for my then young son. It was like a model helicopter. Opening the box, it broke. All right. And that said a lot to me. And this is 5 years ago. 6 years ago, and I already had been cutting it down a lot just because of the way the economy was going. But that said a lot to me. That said, you know, these things obviously are not made to last. They're meant to be thrown away and replaced, even electronics. I mean, these people who are camping out at Best Buy, I saw in a Fox affiliate in Tampa Bay. In St. Petersburg, some people have been camping out in front of Best Buy since last Monday with a tent. And they come and they take turns so that they can be first in line to be able to buy a 42-inch plasma TV screen for like $500 or something. And okay, yeah, that's a good price, but why is it worth altering your lifestyle for? Are we that owned by our possessions?
And I think we're better than that, but the people who run the society don't want us to be better than that.
Right, exactly. No, they want us to continue to buy, to continue to shop, to blow our money. Like a clip I saw on The Daily Show a year or two ago, where they were talking about the economy and Christmas. They were goofing around how in July, the Secretary of Treasury was going to call an emergency Christmas so that we could be able to boost the economy.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it on that note. That's a wonderful note. We wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and we will be back next Monday with the War Report featuring Marshawn McDermott, our military affairs commentator. That's next Monday from noon to 1. And it's incontextreport.com is our website.
Find us on Facebook. Look us up on YouTube. We're adding content all the time.
Thanks for joining us.
Take it easy, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. What is it?